Awesome, awesome. We're back. Hello, everybody. I'm hanging out with Magda Bjorkman. She's a production manager. What does that mean? Well, you know what? I'm sure you're going to find out. She's going to be talking about minimal viable process and how to find flow in your ways of working. And you're going to learn what that means as I did. So, Magda, take it away.
Thank you, Indy. And hello, everyone. I hope you can see my presentation. Feel free to drop questions in the chat. I will take them after the presentation. My name is Magda Bjorkman. I come from Poland originally, so I used to work in Wrocław before, but some years ago, I think it's eight and a half years, I moved to Stockholm. So as you can imagine, the weather here is rather northern European, although it was pretty rainy today. My work history, I used to work in localization, of course. I was project manager in localization for Techland, releasing Dying Light. Maybe some of you know this game. And then when I moved to Sweden, I worked for 5 years with mobile games at King. A lot of kind of new games, prototypes. We did a lot of playtests, which was super, super fun. And then I moved to work with like the flagship titles, so Candy Crush and then like Candy Crush Friends, which is another game under this franchise. I also worked out of the gaming industry via Play and Spotify, where I learned a lot of like modern software development and some processes and mental models that I'm also bringing here with this, with me to this talk. And then I moved to back to production, to being producer and production manager at Arrowhead. So I helped the team last year to release Helldivers 2, which just came out. So if you haven't played it, that's a great opportunity to do so. And now currently I'm in Mojang working with a company that created Minecraft. I just started. So it's been a fun journey and I've learned a lot along the way. And obvious, very important fact about me, I do own 2 cats and these cats will be showing up throughout the presentation because I cannot do a talk or a presentation without them. Their names are Loki and Freya, and I learn from them a lot, especially about rest. They are very, very good at resting. So by the end of the session, like what you will learn, I think it's important to set some expectations, because like before I was talking to Indy and he asked me, so you're talking about workflows, right? And I'm like, yeah, but not really. It will be a little bit more existential maybe, but also very practical. You will get some practical things. So you will learn, and that's the core of this presentation, you will learn what questions to ask yourself and your team in order to reach your dream MVP, minimum viable process that you need to run your studio or your team in a smooth way. You will have a toolbox of methods to use on your journey. So my goal is that you at least come out from this presentation with one tool, like one thing that you will take a note of, one thing, oh, this is a good stuff. I can use it with my team, maybe tomorrow, maybe today, and you'll be inspired by it. This is the whole goal. And you'll have an opportunity to ask some more in-depth question about all things I mentioned during this short talk. It's gonna be a little bit surface level. I wasn't sure what the audience is going to be. So I try to make it universal, but of course, every single topic and every single question, like I can go, you know, like this Russian doll kind of deeper and deeper into the details. So feel free to ask me and chat me up on Discord later as well. I'm more than happy to elaborate. And yeah, you will experience at least one more cat picture, and let's not kid ourselves. There's going to be more than one. You know it. I know it. Let's go. So some definitions. To start with, what is minimum viable process? We talk a lot about minimum viable product, but I do like this word or set of words, minimum viable process, which for me is the simplest way to reach your vision with maximum flow and minimum friction. And this requires one more definition. What do I mean by flow? And flow has 2 aspects to it. One aspect is more production related. So from a dictionary or encyclopedia, it's the action or fact of moving along in a steady continuous stream. So when you imagine the production, just the pipelines flowing, nothing blocking it, the throughput is good, flow is unobstructed, it's a great state to be in. You can predict everything and it's very nice. But also a state of flow, like in psychology, is this melting together of action and consciousness, the state of finding a balance between skill and how challenging the task is. Is the state when you just, when work does itself, and you can be in it yourself, like when you're coding or when you're painting and where you're doing something that you really love creating. But you can also be in it as a team when you feel that you are developing something together, when the work flows. And I think that this is the state that we are aiming for. Of course, we want to earn money. We want to have like our games to be great successes, but also life is meaningless, I think, if it's just struggle and buckets of money. We kind of want to have fun while doing it. We want to reach the state of flow. So that's like two aspects of it that I want to cover, and one does not exist to me without the other. So let's jump right into it to assess whether you reached your MVP, because maybe you already have all the process you need. Maybe you are in a state that this is you, this is great. You need to ask yourself only three questions to know whether you are there or not. But wait, there is a catch. Who is you in this context? So I know that in the audience, like you might be a solopreneur, you might be a group of two just starting off, or you might be scaling up. Maybe you are a group of founders, you're scaling up, you're employing people, maybe you have quite a big studio on your hands. So who do I mean by you? And this is the first thing that you need to establish even before answering these three questions, because this is going to be the core group that answers these questions. So minus three, we start from point minus three, identify your leadership team. Very important, sometimes overlooked thing, because this might be simple in a small organization. If you're just a founder or two founders or three, of course, you know, you're your leadership team. You are the people that are making the game, but also you're like self-led, and it's great. It's very easy to identify. But the more you grow, the more difficult it becomes, because if you're hiring people or if you're hiring right person, are they also on the leadership team? Are they outside? How involved they are in taking the decisions? Like, this is something that if you don't make it explicit, it will solve itself somehow, but often it kind of lands in these murky waters and in the gray zone, and you're not totally sure. So it's really good to establish that first. So minus two, when you already discovered like, oh, we are the leadership team, we are the ones that are kind of calling the shots. It's us, yeah, we know that. Then it's useful to recognize what sort of leadership team you have and what type you need to be. And I've seen a lot of these different types in organizations, so that it's not that one type is the best. It really depends what you need at the moment and what are your goals. Like, this is from a book, and I will mention this book later, so you will be able to note it down, or you will get the slides, of course, as well. There are four core types of teams, of like leadership teams, and you might recognize it from your different companies that you worked with, from like different surroundings that you were in. I will just go through it very briefly. I don't want to focus on it too much, but information sharing team, which is just we gather, we share information, and the leader takes the decision, a little bit maybe leader-driven, like dictatorship, not necessarily, but like one person usually drives and you kind of share information. Then consultative team, that you consult each other, you develop like some sort of feedback loops, but still the leader or one person or a couple of people take the decisions. Then coordinating team, share collective responsibility for implementation of the initiative. So there's a lot of coordination going on, a lot of like operational level, maybe decision making, but there is no like huge horizon of it. So it's not maybe super strategic. And then kind of the last stage is the decision making team. So actually like a strong leadership team that takes decisions together, that is empowered enough to take decisions together, that knows how to communicate these decisions to the rest of the team, that is collaborating and enabling the rest of the team to help them take these decisions. And the more you go into the right towards the decision-making team, the smaller the team should be, because they need to act quite fast. So then if you suddenly like have a team of 20 people, of 30 people, then you really need to decide like, oh, who should be in the steering team, in this team who's actually setting the vision, who's providing the constraints, who is setting the direction for the rest of the team. Then the bigger you are, the more important it is to make it very explicit. And there are some pointers. How can you find people for your leadership team? It's one of the most crowded slides of this presentation. I will not go through it in details. You can read that later, and I recommend the book as well. But some of the things that I would like to highlight here is that to be a good leader, you not only need to be a good specialist within your area, so maybe it's marketing, maybe it's business, maybe it's codes, maybe it's art, but you also need to have like some level of thinking that can connect all the dots together, that you can not only think from your discipline, but take other perspectives and actually think about this whole like company as a whole and project as a whole. And there are some other types here. And also the more in a leadership position you are, even if it's a very small team, the more people work you do, like always, even if you're a specialist, like people are everything, and a lot of challenges stem from being very different and seeing world in a different way. So then this point, look for signs of empathy. That's very important to kind of be able to take other perspectives, to also bring them to the table, to advocate for others who are not at the table. These are important traits to look for in your leadership team. And also some people might not want to be on a leadership team. Maybe you have a great CTO, but he's like, I like to just be here, but I would like to put like another person in the leadership team that actually sets the direction. There are different constellations, and I've seen a lot of different ones. So it's not necessarily given that all these people are on a leadership team. Sometimes you can think about it and discuss until you get like, oh, this is the best steering team. It actually makes sense for us, and it will enable us to go faster, because that's what this is all about. Yeah, and if you onboard a new person to your leadership team, let's say you're four founders, you bring up new person, you know that you're still all going to be leaders, going to take decisions together. These three things are good to be explicit about. What are they expected to contribute to the team? How are team members supposed to behave? And what characteristic of this person behavior risk hurting the team, and what is helping the team? And the more straightforward and honest you are about it, the better conversation is, and the less surprises you have down the line. Because sometimes you meet someone, it seems it's great, the chemistry is awesome, but after a while some conflicts start to pop up, and then the more things you actually make explicit and you put them in the open, the easier it is then to go back to them and actually reference them and talk about it. The more things you keep just, you don't talk about it, you just assume, the harder it is to bring them up later. So this is the book. I can really recommend it, especially if you're growing senior leadership teams, by Ruth Waitman. There are a few other tools in this book as well. It's a really good read if you want to learn some things about team creation, team development, and evolving your leadership teams. Okay, a little case study before we move to actual meat of the presentation. How leadership team is important. So this was in a bigger organization. This was actually outside of gaming industry. But we had a very visionary leader that was trying to empower the leadership team. And the leadership team was 20 people. And it wasn't a chosen leadership team. It kind of grew organically. Like the company was small at first, but then it really, really grew. It was really successful. And the leadership team just grew automatically with it. Just new people, new kind of team leads started being added to this leadership team until it became big, and it was super tough to take any decisions in that team, and it was a very consensus driven team, so everyone needed to agree, which, as you can imagine, with 20 people, very hard. And the head of the department, he didn't want to be a dictator. He wanted to empower them. No, but you should take these decisions. But we don't know how. You should take the decision. And they were kind of in this lock of non-decision making. And then this material from this book really helped us. What we did in the end was to clarify, like being very explicit. So what are the decisions that you actually need to take yourself, because you are the head of the department, you need to take some decisions. But also we split the whole part of the company, the whole department, into three sub areas. And from them, like representatives usually were swarming around different initiatives and different areas of interest, and they took decisions together and then referred back, or sorry, that they did proposals together and then referred back to the group that could do decision making. And we also implemented a way to do the decision making, because it's not as easy as you think. You think, yeah, taking decisions, like, oh, we take decision and we go. But how do you know that is decision? How do you know that everyone in your team knows that this was actually a decision that was taken? If you're a big team, I do recommend taking some framework. How do you actually want to take decisions? Or at least if you feel like, oh, here we're in a lock, we don't really know, then take, oh, let's take this framework and take decisions in this way. And we took a consent-based decision-making, which is that the team or a subset of a team suggests a proposal for a change, let's say, or for a particular decision point. Then we go around with qualifying questions. There are like a few rounds of it, gather objections, gather feedback, like refine the proposal. And then if no one disagrees, that's the difference between consensus and consent. And consent, if no one disagrees, that means that the proposal is taken. And this sped up the decision making a lot. So that's like one of the ways that you can take if you're locked in the decision gridlock. And another thing, like maybe for big organizations, but delegation canvas, if you're delegating decisions, you're especially you're, let's say, a new leadership group and you have a team that you want to delegate, you feel very strongly about it, but you are not totally sure how to delegate or whether they will actually deliver, then you can use like a simple kind of framework. Oh, this is delegation canvas. These are like some ground rules, key responsibilities, dependencies, external constraints, key challenges, and other things. And this is like our contract. I trust you that you will, that you or this group of people or a person, you will actually come up with a good way of solving it. But this is our contract that we are setting that you will actually do it. And this works well for both parties, because you as leader or leadership team, you know exactly what sort of work is going on. And then the person or the group that is getting it, they also know what are the expectations. And when they need to negotiate something, they actually have an artifact to negotiate with. So there's, again, not reading between the lines and not just guessing what was it that you meant. So I do like kind of codification of some things. Again, not too much process, but if you feel you need it, then you need it. And if you don't need it, you don't. And you can read more about these tools. There are a lot more tools like this on Sociocracy 3.0. You can just browse through it. And I suggest experimenting with it as well a little bit. It's quite fun. Like they have a lot of different things that I've used at different points of my life. And, you know, sometimes, especially if you're blocked, use a new tool. And these are simple ones. It's not usually overcomplicated. Use something, maybe it will unlock you. And you don't have to marry it. You can just use it once and then see if that works or not. Okay, great. We reached point zero. So you have your leadership team. Amazing. Congratulations. The hard work is done. And now we can go back to the three questions that will actually help you assess your MVP. And the three questions are extremely simple. So you probably can have some thoughts around them now. Do you know what you're doing? Or do we know as a team, what are we doing? Are we doing it right? And do we enjoy it? And these three questions, if you ask yourself, and if the answer is resounding yes, then you probably have your minimum viable process. You can finish this presentation. You can go home and be happy. But of course, there's a but. Assumption is the mother of all screw-ups. So if you say resounding yes, but don't really look under the hood of this yes, then sometimes means that you assume a lot of things. And it's, again, it's good to just put them out there, discuss them. If you check, like kind of fact check them, yeah, it's definitely a yes from all sides, then it's a yes, but maybe it's not. So there are some follow-up questions to these three basic questions. Do we know what we are doing? And here is Freya not knowing what she's doing, apparently. The follow-up questions to do we know what we are doing are, what are we doing? So, of course, we're making a game, right? But what sort of game actually we're doing? Like, do we have these kind of basic things actually mapped out? And if we have them mapped out, are we all talking about the same thing? And it's good, even if you have your like vision board, you have your mission statements and everything, just gather your leadership team together and just ask yourselves, like each of you, what are we doing? And see if the answers are the same. If they are the same, that you're still in the same mind space. If not, then maybe there is some discussion to be had. Sometimes when you start something, you know exactly what you're doing. Like, this is the thing. But then after time passes, you grow, you change direction. Maybe sometimes you kind of diverge in a bit separate ways and you have different assumptions. So then going back to this very, very core basic question, it can create space for really interesting conversations. And then, of course, why are we doing it? So, and subset of this question, who are we doing it for? So, I mean, you know, always look for who are you actually targeting and who are you doing it for? Is the players, of course, but also when it comes to yourself, like who are you doing it for? Like who's benefiting from what you're doing? If it's the players, like what sort of players? Maybe you have like vision that's larger than that. Maybe it's society. Maybe it's like you want to impact something or someone. Or maybe it's like you. Also keep it simple, but keep it explicit. And the next one, a little bit tricky. How do we know what we're doing? So, okay, you answer these two questions, and in this moment, it's kind of clear. But then at every moment that you're actually doing your work in your daily business, how do we know what we're doing? Like, what are the different, like, do we have any artifacts or do we have any way of communicating it to ourselves, to the rest of our team, to the outside world? How do we know and how do others know? That's the next question. What are we doing? And the last one, most existential one, but the one that I notice not everyone always asks themselves, do we really believe in what we're doing? Because that's also one part that sometimes starts deteriorating after time. Like sometimes we believe in the beginning, like, yes, this is the mission. This is what we believe in. But in time, maybe it shifted. Maybe we needed to pivot a couple of times. Maybe we have difficult relationship with investors, publishers, whatever. And some things just changed. So, and some conflicts started popping up and we don't know why, because we're kind of still on the same trajectory, or we think so. But are we? And do we really believe in it? And then if not, explore that together. And here are some, like, what's kind of in more... project process terms it relates to. So your mission, what are we doing? Your mission, why are you doing it? Vision, define some core values that you have. If you share them, it's great. Maybe there are some values that you don't share. That's also worth discussing. How do we know what we're doing? Like strategy, is it explicit? Is it clear? Is it short? Is it 20 pages? I've seen that. And measurable goals, core metrics. And again, all of these things, it doesn't have to be a book of things. It can be one pager. It can be like a very simple thing. But if you just can in your team discuss it, and this is what we're all like, we're literally on the same page. This is exactly what you need. It doesn't have to be over engineered. The discussion is important, and then kind of agreement. And there are some tools that you might use, especially if you don't know where to start with some of these things. A good thing to Google, for example, is Team Canvas. There are a ton of different Team Canvases that you can dig up and use. So this is just a simple one that I sometimes use, where we identify like your purpose, your common goals, your values, your needs and expectations, like all of these core things that tell you what are you doing. And it can be a two-hour meeting. Sometimes it requires more talking, of course, but you will know, and you will know which parts of it you get stuck on. You don't have to have all the answers at all points, but it's good to start having these conversations and to plot them into your busy business life, trying to meet your goals, trying to set the budgets and earn the money. It's good to also spare time to have these like more in-depth existential conversations, and then make sure that something is left out of them so you can revisit it in a year when you change, your goals change, maybe you change as people, you can revisit them and see, oh, this was our purpose, but now it feels a bit different. So it's important to have like a little bit of trace of it somewhere. Yeah, so some pointers when it comes to what you're doing: be explicit, be visual, like our brain loves visuals. If you have something visual that you can refer back to, it will stick to your brain. Reschedule time for it. Don't underestimate the power of existential conversations. Like, it's hard, it gets postponed a lot. But really, like, prioritize it. It can be, you know, if you're a small team, it can be a conversation over beer, but still have like, there probably is one person that likes to write or like draw or something, and they will create something nice out of this conversation. Just make sure it happens. Go for consent over consensus. So what I mentioned before, sometimes consent is a faster way of decision making. But don't compromise on core values and purpose. These are two things that will really bite you if you compromise on them. If you really realize that you have, or one person in your team has very different core values than the rest, conflicts after some time will emerge. So it's really good to discuss it. And I'm sorry, it's cold season in Sweden. It's very cold, and at the office there's a virus going on. So my voice is a little bit hoarse. I'll try to drink my ginger tea and not cough too much. Next one. Don't be afraid of constructive conflict. Depends which culture, which part of the world you're from. You might be more or less, or your personality, prone to constructive conflict. But it's important that it's not like a toxic conflict. It's not shouting at each other. It's being curious about different ideas. It's being curious about different values. It's like, oh, so you thought we're doing it because of that, but that's curious. Why is that? What drives you to kind of keep that curiosity? And especially when a new person comes to your team, maybe you expected something else, but stay curious and don't be afraid of this conflict. It will bring a lot of good stuff. And be aware of the grown zone. If you don't know this term, this is going to be a very useful term for you in your very long conversations and discussions. It's a very important part of decision making. It's not a very fun part of decision making, but you can embrace it. So if you know like the double diamond, or like the diamond shape of decision making, you're first like diverging, a lot of opinions, a lot of like stuff is flowing in the air, you kind of brainstorm, and you start like going broader, and then you reach like this grown zone, like, oh, we're so different, we're so in conflict, we will never ever take that decision. And that's a very uncomfortable place to be, and it happens. Like, I led a lot of like prototyping and design sprints and design thinking, and usually we land in the grown zone at some point, and this is the moment when it's like, we put so much work into this. It's like we're not aligned. We're not getting anywhere. Just let's abandon it and go, or just let's take any decision and, you know, be all done with it. Well, this is a very like pivotal part of decision making, so you need to, or I suggest that you acknowledge it. Like, ooh, we reached the grown zone. I see the conflict. Nice. It's getting juicy. You know. It's not comfortable, so you need to embrace a bit of the discomfort. And then there are like some tactics that you can actually start converging, usually after some time of groaning, if you're respectful, if you actually ask questions, if you're curious, and if you always refer back to the goal of the decision making. Oh, but we need to do it because of that. This is our point. Then slowly you will converge and you will actually come to the decision. If you feel that you're staying in the grown zone and there's just no way out, you're just stuck in these never-ending conversations and nothing ever gets decided, then I do really suggest to get some help from the outside, uninvolved third party. It can be from your company, it can be from a friendly company, it can be a coach. I used to work as like agile coach and organization coach for many years. So part of my role was actually like hold the container and like lead people through these hard conversations, like help them, like hold their hand a little bit and help them. Here, we are here now. It's super uncomfortable, but we will get out of it and you will reach your goals. You will like reach your decision, but we just have to do some things. So, and that person is uninvolved. So they don't really care about your very heated conflict. They just care about you going through the process in a good way. So sometimes if you feel you're always stuck there, take someone. It can be just like one-time help. There are a ton of coaches out there as well if you want to employ someone. Or just, you know, take someone who is good at talking to people and they can help you with some external perspective. I really recommend it. A little tiny case study too, divided vision and leadership. That was on a very small experimental game project within a bigger studio. It was a very new concept. It was a bit weird kind of game app, you know, very weird idea, but kind of cool. I can't say too much about it, unfortunately, but it was very cool. Very unclear positioning of the game within companies' brands and very unclear product market fit, like from the get-go. It was cool, you know, but not super thought through. They gathered a team. The team was very motivated, very fun, super fun to work with. But the problem was, and the team did not necessarily know that, although the team was a bit divided too, but in the leadership, like not everyone was buying into this vision. There were like a couple of people really driving it, like we should try it, this is amazing, this is going to be great, you know, these big personalities. But the studio leadership, they don't really buy into it, and they're kind of, yeah, let's try it, we'll experiment, allow some budget for it, and we'll see. And the game got cancelled. Although the early playtests, we did a few early playtests, were actually showing signs of success, like early, quite good indicators, like retention was pretty good, engagement was nice, but the game was cancelled anyway. And the learnings from that is that when it comes to your what you're doing, like creating a believable vision and targets and communicating it very clearly to the stakeholders is super important, getting their buy-in. Very early testing of assumption behind the vision is necessary. Like you can sell a vision, you can sell like, if you have personality, some now maybe economy is also different, so it's kind of harder. You need to have like very but if someone doesn't fully buy into it, then it might, you know, or it might get a little bit of money, a little bit of budget go somewhere, but then it just kind of fizzles out, which was the case of this one. And it was very sad because the team was super, super into it. Like the process, like, you know, the how was amazing. But because it was kind of dead on arrival, because not everyone, like some key people did not really believe in them and they gave it a little bit of time and then, no, it's not on brand. So make sure that the vision, the why, the who is very, very solid when you're creating something. And you believe in it as well, of course. Do we know what we are doing? Okay, so now we have a yes, a resounding yes. But sometimes we have a yes, but something still doesn't feel right in the team. Maybe someone agrees, but you kind of have doubts. One concept that I bet a lot of you are familiar with is psychological safety. And that's something I will not talk a lot about, but if that is that's like a prerequisite of doing any sort of teamwork, like people need to feel safe to speak up, they need to not feel that they will be punished. And if there's something, usually, oh, you feel you have all of this why very clear, but there is still some disagreement in the team, maybe there's not enough psychological safety for people to actually speak up and to like show what they really think. And then this is like worth exploring and investing and digging a bit deeper into. You can read more. You will get these slides. You will get it. So you can read more about it if you're curious. I will go to the point 2. Are we doing it right? And here is Loki. And Loki is doing everything right, always. He's a very, very stupid cat, but he's very handsome. So, you know, everything that he's doing is just amazing and I love him. So some questions. Now I'll actually move already to the answers, or like two kind of things that might come out of these. So it's important to ask yourself, and this is about process, you know. So I mean, I'm not going to talk about whether you should use Jira or Asana. You need to decide that on your own. I'm sorry, but these are the questions that might lead you to the decision. So from what you're doing at the moment, just like take a bit of a snapshot together, like in your leadership team, and think, what are we doing right and what are we doing wrong? And that is like processes, tools, ceremonies, behaviors, like all the things that you're actually doing. Because often, like I ask when I come like to a new team, a new studio, like, oh, everything is on fire, like it's not working, it's awful. But when I dig deeper into it, a lot of things are actually being done right. Like, oh, maybe we do amazing player testing, or we have amazing already early telemetry or something like that. So some things like, oh, some things we're actually doing right and we want to keep them. And then the problem with introducing new process is, are you throwing out what you already had and what was working? So make sure that you are very explicit about what is actually working. And that you protect it, you keep it, or you evolve it, but that you're very, you know what you're doing right. And then again, how do you know that you're doing it right, and how do you know that you're doing it wrong? Sometimes it's a gut feeling, or like, oh, this process, it's not working, it's awful, I hate it, and I want to change it, it sucks. Okay, but how do you know? Like, what are the symptoms? It's, of course, your gut feeling. I feel sick every time I open Jira, that could be one thing. But then dig a bit deeper. How do you, like, what about it makes you sick? Like, explore it a little bit more. We throw out processes sometimes very fast because we hate them, but we don't explore what about them we actually hate. And might be that it's a fixable process if you look a little bit deeper, and you might change something, change the way that you're using it, or abandon part of it, or... Yeah, anyway, digging a little bit deeper, what it is about it that you're doing right, what it is about it that you're doing wrong. Look at some metrics, or develop some metrics around it. Develop some outcomes, like, what do you want? What do you want from this process? Like, what is the outcome of this process? And is the Jira the right response to that? Maybe it is, maybe it's not. Maybe it's a Google Doc, because it's simpler, because every single person knows how to use it. And Dan from marketing never used Jira in his life, but he's super familiar with Google Docs. So, you know, it might be like, how do you know? Like, that's the thing. Like, how do you know? And then what are we complaining most often? This is my favorite. Like, you know, we try to be, of course, proactive, and we try to be very constructive. But it's very fun to listen to complaints. And I used to do at some points in a team that was very unhappy, like a time-boxed round sessions. So, you know, I mean, even in retrospective, of course, we talk about stuff that didn't go right. But sometimes it's also good to just vent rounds. And we had like this 15 minutes, we just rounds, like we just vent, we just throw it out. And after that, we can go to some constructive thinking. And from these rounds, actually, a lot of good stuff came out, because then people suddenly, you know, lose their inhibitions. Of course, if it's too toxic, then you kind of want to point it out and then maybe go back to like psychological safety and to other things. But as long as it's not toxic and it's not offensive to anyone, round sessions are a great thing. Hear what people are complaining most often about, and that will show you blockers and pain points in the system, and then you will be able to impact them. So what do we complain? What the rest of the team complain? And then the question that I always ask myself, even if everything is working, let's say we have a great process, we are happy with it, what is missing? So if we look like we have our flow, it's great, we don't hear much complaints, but what is missing? And sometimes the answer might be nothing. Sometimes might be, oh, this is missing, but we kind of know and we have it mitigated. Like, oh, maybe we're not really thinking about bringing in user feedback, or whatever else that is, because we're not on this part of the process. But even if it's known, it's still good to have it explicit and always acknowledge that there are also unknown unknowns, that there will be some things that will happen and will force us to change our process sooner or later, and just be ready that they will happen. A thing when it comes to process and when it comes to actual how we are doing it, that I know every one of you knows, but it's good to look at together when it comes to our project. Did we corner ourselves in this triangle? Is everything fixed when it comes to cost, time, and scope? Because when everything is fixed, we are a little bit in the pickle. So I do like to have this triangle with me everywhere and see like, okay, like now we're at this stage. So budget is maybe a little bit movable. Time, no, we're locked for something. Scope, then scope must be like, if cost and time is fixed, scope must be movable. So you might have like your perfect feature list, we need to put it in the game, just whatever. We need to put it in the game. If cost and time are fixed, scope can't be fixed. It's impossible. So if you feel that you cornered yourself, then you need to have a conversation around how to adjust, like how to open up one of these. Because like in the middle is quality, and if all of these are fixed, then the quality is going to be crap and you will not reach your goals anyway. Just a little recap. Now you probably know it, but it's good when it comes to the how to just check in with it. And if something here is like not right, like going wrong with the budget or with the time or with the scope, then that means that the question to are we doing it right is not yes. Never skip a retrospective. You're super busy, or you're only two people, or you're maybe solo. You don't need retrospectives. No, I suggest everything you do, if you have even like just your, even if you're just like a consultant on your own or a freelancer, I still suggest that you have regular retrospectives even with yourself, because that will help you look back and actually have this continuity of process, and you will know what you improved. So I am a super fan, not too many retrospectives as well. There is something called retrospective fatigue if you just kind of do too much of it. But if it's in good slots of time, if you feel that it's bringing effect, then do it. And some examples, of course, a lot of retrospectives. Experiment with different ways of asking questions. I'm also a coach. I'm also a life coach, a personal coach. The way you ask questions matters. And if you do the same questions in a retrospective over and over again, you will get predictable results. Like it will stop bringing value. Shake it up a bit. Ask it from a different direction. Put some visuals to it. Just still keep continuity, still keep the basics, but experiment with how you ask questions. You will get to more meaty bits if you experiment. And yeah, just some examples. And very important part that people often do or try to take a lot of actions from retrospectives. Like, oh, we came up with so many actions. Amazing. I dare you. The next time you think back, you reflect, you retrospect either yourself or with others, decide on one action and track it progress over time. But why one? You can do more. I know that you can do more. However, it is like minimum viable process, right? It's minimum. It's easy to keep one thing in mind. If you have more things, you have to write them down. You have to track them in elaborate ways. You will forget about it. One thing, collaboratively, it's very easy to remember. It's very easy to remind yourselves. Take one thing that you feel will bring impact. If there are more things, they will come up in future retrospectives. They will not get lost, but take just one. And sometimes this action might be building a new behavior. Like, for example, oh, we have this awesome tool. It solves all our problems, but half of the team is not using it, for example. And then building a behavior of actually starting to use this tool, it takes a lot of cognitive powers. And maybe the people that are actually using the tool have to help the people that don't know how. But by taking this one action, oh, let's actually collaboratively build this new behavior and then solidify it. And building a behavior takes time, at least like a month of repeated everyday action. So if you take it one and if you actually do it and check in progress, then you will collaboratively see that it actually brings impact. If you have 10 actions, but you don't do any of them, there is no impact and lost time. And it's the same if you build a new habit yourself, like if you go on a diet or something, like you kind of need to build it slowly until it's just ingrained in you and you do it automatically. We're running out of time, so I will run through the last one very fast. There are some nice slides that you can read and get to know more about it, but I will scramble through it. But one thing that I want to say here, if you feel your cognitive load is too high and you don't have tight deadlines, just production and everything, but still you feel that the way you're doing things could be better, do a tiny, tiny experiment, like the minimum experiments that you can do with a particular thing.
I'm going to pop in for a second. Yeah, don't rush. I'm getting a bunch out of what you're saying. So just keep, you've got plenty of time. Like, don't skip over stuff. Because as soon as you're like, oh, well, look at that. I'm like, no. I want to see what that is. So yeah, just keep going. You're doing it. You're doing great.
Thank you. Yeah, no, I'm sorry. I sometimes talk more than I expect. And in my rehearsal, it took me less time. But, you know how it is. So, yeah, small experiments. This is my early days as Agile coach. Very, very, very long time ago. A hypothesis-driven experiment. So, this is also, this will help your game design. This will help anything. Like experiments with your ways of working as you experiment with your game. So design a hypothesis-driven experiment. Here, in this case, it was with a team that had problems with testing the stuff that they actually created in-game. They were pushing very late in the release, like right before the release. It was often broken. And the quality was quite bad. So what we tried to do, how do we create a process that actually helps us test our things earlier? And the hypothesis that we took was that if we do, you will learn an important Swedish word, which is fika, which is a coffee break. And it's the most important Swedish word that you will learn if you go to Sweden. Say fika, they will treat you as sweet. So we designed like a weekly team fika with buying, a little bit of pastries, like having the school coffee break and testing what we created in the week together, even if it was like super broken. But actually that requires pushing it early enough for the test. And people love food, people love sweets, or at least this team really loved sweets. So the frequency or the attendance was great. And it actually improved our quality a lot. And so hypothesis, that's doing these fikas will actually encourage the team to produce a stable, testable build. Baseline, team testing, right? So baseline is what the state is now. Team testing right before the freeze, pushing to master late, or even postponing pushing to master to the next release. It was a live game. And what I will observe during this experiment, so how will I know that it's actually bringing effects, like number of people participating, length of the testing, time between finding fixing bugs, so quality, and how will I gather information? So kind of, setting these cornerstones of the experiments. It made it fun for me as well to actually observe, to see. And then I could report back to the team that, past month, these metrics actually improved, and it also motivated them to continue with this ritual. And as every ritual, it deteriorated after a few months, and then we needed to change it and to do something else to actually keep the momentum. It was very fun. Yeah, so don't try to fix everything in the same time. Find the area of potentially big impact where we can take a small action to push it in the right direction. One can live with a crappy process for a long time without lives being lost. You probably know if you ever worked with Jira, but building a steady improvement habit is more important than constant revolutions. Like I've seen, and I was guilty of that at some point too. Like, this is not working. Let's just exchange it. Let's find a new tool and trying 5 different tools in a year. But sometimes the slow evolution and improvement is more important than doing a huge revolution. extinguish fires, but leave time for evolving your process. And the best process is the process that works for you at any given time and is flexible enough to be evolved, because no process will be good forever. Processes deteriorate. You will need to change them. So don't corner yourself in your process. Make sure that it's as flexible that if it deteriorates, you can change something in it. Okay, last bit. I think this one is going to be short and fun, because that's the question. Third question, very important question. Do we enjoy it? Freya is enjoying life every day, just getting petted. So be Freya. But also we can ask follow-up questions. What do we enjoy? And how do we keep on enjoying it? And what sucks? And at this moment, is it okay that this thing sucks? And can we make it not suck? So what do we enjoy? Some conversations that we have before point to it. And also team health, that I will mention in a second. And what sucks, like often connected to the how, often connected to the process. Not always, but often. Get to know your team. Also take time, and also take time to be explicit about who your team members are, like what are their strengths, values, norms. And this is, again, you can, there will be links so you can check it out, but Google team charter, a lot of team charters. It's nice to have a little bit, you know, you can outsource it to the internet these days, so many things, and you just have the conversation. You don't have to prepare the elaborate things, which is amazing. And the thing that I really like when I enter a new team and I have people reporting to me or I have colleagues, I always suggest doing a user manual exercise. Like, how do you operate me? Like, you know, not operate on me, but like, how do you work with me? What gives me energy? What drains energy from me? How do I act under stress? What are the best ways to communicate with me? This question I really like. What things people might misunderstand about me? If you have a conversation around it, you can refer back to it after time, and it's easier to understand, like, oh, maybe that person makes bad jokes all the time because they're insecure. Totally not me, but, you know, might be someone. And then you understand it's a space where you actually can be open about it and create a little bit of safety together as well and good rapport. And team health checks. This is from Spotify, a Spotify health check that a lot of companies are using, at least in Stockholm these days. The bigger you are, you kind of want to have an overview. So what is your team health? And that's team health, organizational health, tech health, a lot of different questions that you can ask. You can explore that. Important for the team to have the space to talk, but also for you to see the overview of how your team is doing at any given point, and where are the red zones where you might support them. Case study 4, very, very short, embrace the suck. I was once involved in a very, very soul draining process that involved legal checks for assets and other stuff. It was very frustrating, very long process, very like deteriorated over years. Just, I do not wish that on anyone. And I did that with two other producers. So we had like this little support group, and we decided on like two ways of being. So one, embracing the suck. So, okay, it is what it is, but let's show empathy to each other. Let's have this fun banter behind the curtains and just make it a little bit lighter, and it will suck for a while. No, like we can't really not make it not suck totally. So let's have this round session. Let's do like we did funny memes and stuff. And it was still soul draining, but at least it was funny, you know. And then we decided, okay, so how do we improve the suck? And we got like a few actions. And over the time, the suck was lesser and lesser. And now it lives in the stories. We still have the memes. It's amazing. So sometimes the things that suck most make for the best stories in the future. And that's also worth remembering, I guess. Yeah, so going back to the three questions, you all have three yeses. Amazing. Hopefully you talk through all of it and now you are in the green. And the thoughts that I want to leave you with, if it ain't broke, don't break it. So if your process is working for you at any given moment, don't break it. But remember that systems change over time and they need constant monitoring and evolving. So take time to ask yourself these questions on a regular basis. That's how you create the culture that you want to have in your team. And with that, I will end my presentation.
Wow, that was good. I thought that was, if it ain't broke, don't fix it. If it ain't broke, don't fix it. Because when you try and fix it, then you break it. But I love that. If it ain't broke, don't break it. That's good. Man, so somebody had asked, can we get the presentation? And I said, yes, you have to go to powgroupconsulting.com/indiegamebusiness. And then you have to sign up. It's free. And that just signs you up. You get all the presentations for all of these talks. Man, that was good stuff. I need to go back. And then you should write a book is what you should do. Like how to, you know, fire up your team, keep them organized, all of that. Because that was some, yeah, pro here, he says something. A lot of these points you come across as a freelance artist, good stuff. That's for sure, because, you know, we get so wrapped up in how we do things, right? That when somebody else comes in or somebody else you work with does things different, it kind of, you know, throws you off a little bit. For example, Ash, our community manager, she's amazing, but she does do things a little different than I do. But that being said, she's actually fired me up to be better at what I do, because by watching her do something awesome, I realize where I fall short, you know. That's good stuff. So I've got a good question for you. And this is, you know, I guess this is about workflows and stuff, but when I was younger, I used to think that multitasking, oh, that is a skill. Mm. That is great. You know, I can do five things at once. But I started to realize that if I'm doing four things at once, that means I only have 25% of my attention on all of those things. And there was no way that anybody could have ever told me that multitasking is bad. No. So how would you tell somebody that, man, when you multitask, your attention is spread so thin that you're not really paying attention?
Yeah, exactly. And I would say that it's even less than 25%, because there is this little thing that we call context switch. And the more you do context switch during the day, the more your cognitive load is actually like raising. So you actually do a lot less than 25% if you do four tasks in a day. But the thing is that we all know, or a lot of us know it, but we still do it because it feels good to be busy and to do this, like, oh, we're doing this and we're doing that. And it feels amazing. And I fall into this every day. I mean, as working with production, you do fall into this, but then actually creating like areas of focus and space for strategic thinking and space for that's super important. And there are strategies to do it, but again, it's like habits that we create because we are so used to just this hamster wheel and just busy. So you need to very consciously create habits to fight against it, because it's natural to want that.
Because it's very easy to be in a meeting and then bing, your Discord goes off and your head swivels. And then you start typing in there, but you're still in the meeting. And then somebody says something, you go, huh? Well, you're not multitasking. You just switched to what you were doing. And it's such a, I realize, and sometimes I have to force myself to focus because I'm guilty of that. I'll be like working. I'm like, you know what? I want to play a game for a minute. And then, here's another pro for 4210, I would add 1 point. If you think about teaming up with your friends or family, think twice.
Yeah, there's already so much baggage with friends and family, and a lot of things that we don't maybe make explicit, as I kind of here suggested, that it's very easy to fall into the conflict area. It's still doable if you kind of like make these things explicit and if you actually talk about them. It is doable, but it's always challenging. So yeah, I agree with that comment. Like, make sure that you have all your bases covered if you actually
Because there's actually pros as well to working with your friends and family, because you know them and you know what they're capable of and you know their weaknesses and strengths as well. But then again, because you are so close, like what is that saying? The people you hurt the most are the ones that are closest to you, you know? like
Or still, I mean, keep my husband used to work with his cousin for many years, so they have it's all, I mean, figured out, but also having like the right expectations, so they're super aware of each other's flaws, so they don't get that irritated about each other's flaws anymore, because they kind of know, oh, you're an organizational just
more weirdo,
and you will not. So having the right expectations is important, and sometimes like having this conversation is also important, but the more, the closer you are and the more baggage there is in the past, then I would not suggest it. If you feel that you can communicate very openly and clean the air, then that might still be a good idea.
Right. And you know what? The biggest takeaway that I personally got from what you said was work on one thing at a time. Because me, I'm all like, this is an issue, this is an issue, this is an issue, this one, let's solve them all right now. But you know what?
Yeah.
It makes so much sense. Just do one
thing. Exactly. And yeah. And if you struggle with it and you still have this, because I have like multi-threads in my brain, put them down somewhere. Store them away for a little bit and just take one, and the rest, you know, it's kind of literally put a pin in them, like literally, like, you know, I'm putting pin in these things now and I'm doing this one thing, and I'm turning off notifications, like, just, you know, for at least for an hour, and I'm just doing this one thing. It's really, it will speed you up.
Right. I mean, even nowadays our phones have focus time, right?
Yeah.
Focus time. Well, thank you so much, Magda. This is awesome. We got to get out of here. Pevs is going to be up with our next talk. Yes, thank you so much. This was amazing. I am actually going to go through your presentation and apply that with some stuff for me. So thank you so much for that. It was awesome.
Thank you, everyone, for listening. I hope you took something out of it, and I'll see you.